absolutely obvious that, yes, that's a facade and a reality. So the first one, for example, there is no unemployment but nobody works, means those multiple tea breaks and social atmosphere and infinite inability to work at full capacity because, as people used to say, they pretend they pay, we pretend we work. So it's a mutual understanding, right? It's a social contract. So every paradox, and I decode them in the book, which I don't want to do here, but the, maybe just to bring up the idea of blood, which spells as bacon, lettuce, and tomato. Or bacon, lettuce, avocado, tomato. Depending
I didn't think
on,
of that before.
On, depending on your taste. But this BLAT practices of getting favors from people you know and exchanging informal favors or circumventing formal procedures with help of personal contacts has been really instrumental to address issues of the economy of shortage.
Yeah.
And you know, the Kornay's work, Janusz Kornay's work on the economy of shortage, which pretty much has been the economic model for multiple socialisms that we yeah. had around the globe. And blood is actually complementary to that, because when you have a situation of shortage, what you do, you try to circumvent it by relying on favors from friends and relations. Mm-hmm. And that actually is not universal. I mean, that's not unique,
right?
And not specific to Russia at all. And every society we've been looking at within the Global Informality Project has an analogous yeah. practice.
And it's interesting, too, because I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'll remind listeners, and maybe you know of it, too. There's a famous skit by the Soviet comedian Arkady Rykin about shortage, where he yes. says, and the final conclusion is, one of the things that shortage is, it's the glue that holds social relations together. And he says, imagine if there's no shortage, we would be an atomized, individualistic society without these relations, informal relations. And I found that incredibly insightful, even though it was a, you know, comedic act.
That's exactly, you know, a very important point, because a lot of people, when I did my research in post-socialist period, had that comment that blood has gone, and some people miss it, because for many people, what they did, it was friendship. Mm-hmm. Blood was what other people did. And that kind of misrecognition game, where if I do it, it's friendship. If you do it, it's blood.
Right.
Allowed those informal practices to be criticized and not really normalized, mm-hmm. but also pervasive.
Right.
So that actually is the key of that paradox. That shops right. are empty, fridges are full.
Let's get into some of the issues that you bring up. Go ahead, Ruslana.
I wanted to bring us back to the title of the book, which is structured around the idea of pendulum and the paradox. So you talked a little bit about the various paradoxes. Could you tell us more how these two terms relate? Like, what do they allow you to do for the analysis of Russia?
I think it's a very good question. And I've contemplated originally when I was thinking about this book that maybe I should talk about problems versus puzzles, paradoxes versus practices. So I was guided by the folklore and that everyday wit that you find always in Russian sources. You know, the paradoxes, for example, six paradoxes of socialism have been very crucial for me to identify which practices are hidden, but hidden from the outsiders, but absolutely familiar and everyday for insiders. And that already is a paradox, because you have something like a know-how, which all insiders know, outsiders have no way of guessing. So how do you get to that reality, especially that these paradoxes capture something which is key to the transformation of society. With that, I would give you the seventh paradox, which is post-Soviet. Everyone voted in favor of the system, but it has collapsed anyway. That is, to me, is the biggest puzzle, you know, of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And how do we approach that fundamental shift, which actually generated huge debates around Russian studies, because we started thinking about Soviet era as a 70 years of an experiment. Mm-hmm. So hoping that Russia will become normalized, you know, returning to the linear projection of, you know, the world modernization.
The Soviet period is being cast as kind of a Sonderweg.
Exactly.
Throwing the Russian people and the world off if it's progressive rise to greatness or whatever one may say.
But what happened though, the AIDS paradox came through because the system has collapsed, but it has reemerged in 30 years.
One of the interesting things about your book is the form too, in that you include artwork by yourself. Each chapter starts with artwork and it references a song. The book actually has a soundtrack called The System Made Me Do It. Great name, by the way. And I want to have you talk about, and I should say that the music is composed by Benjamin Woodgates. I want to play a bit of one of the first songs, Particles/Waves. And this accompanies your chapter on Russian immigration. And the artwork you have is Scapegoat. So let me play like 20 seconds of the music. And then I'd like to have you talk about why you did this and describe the art and what the music means for your chapter on immigration. Okay, so what is this all about, to put it simply?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking this question, because, of course, that is the key development of my own academic way of dealing with complexity of Russia, is to try to create shortcuts for explaining that complexity. So the idea of patterns, as I said, it came from the Global Informality Project, and I abstracted patterns of informal power or patterns of informality that I find everywhere. I've published 3 volumes of the encyclopedia, which actually stand alone. They are so fat, each volume. And what has been the easiest way for me to explain the unexplainable and to explain the complexity of informality around the globe is to distill the patterns and express them in art, which are pieces made of antique metal and tools and antique wood, something which is as ancient as the world, but they are not disappearing completely, but we need to find their place and we need to give them some attention. So the idea of the art collection on the patterns of informal power, and that was an exhibition in Paris that was called This System Made Me Do It, was actually quite literally that. I try to express the informal power that I know is really effective in so many societies around the globe and capture those elusive patterns of its operation. So the idea of a scapegoat, the work that you mentioned, and its relevance for the analysis of immigration from Russia comes hand in hand with a biblical pattern of a scapegoat, where community places its sins collectively on a particular scapegoat who then is pushed out of the community. What I see by looking in the text on the waves of immigration from Russia is exactly that. People who are not agreeable to Sistema, people who are not consensual, people who Sistema feels to be a threat to its own reproduction become pushed out. And of course, the main paradox of immigration is that those people who want to leave, they cannot. But those people who don't want to leave, they are pushed out of Russia. And that has been the way, actually, with every wave of immigration that I find about nine, historically speaking. And when I created that work, what I meant is exactly that periodic expulsion of people who would be a non-systemic opposition or a-Sistema people. Coming to music now, there is a fantastic review of this musical album that was actually commissioned to Benjamin Woodgates to try and capture these universal patterns and abstract them from the social context in music. And in this particular piece on particles and waves, we of course refer to the Schrödinger's cat paradox, where a particle could be a particle or a wave. And it's really, you know, like the cat could be both alive and dead. But it depends in quantum mechanics on the point of the observation. So in a way, that state of ambivalence or superposition, where you could be both a wave and a particle, get resolved at the point of observation. So the ambivalence as the unresolvable, unresolved state, which only gets pronounced or surfacing in a certain context-bound environment, is something that is central to the idea of the book, where I claim to be looking through the lens of ambivalence on those paradoxes that we see in Russia. The music is written for two marimbas, and of course, the composer is probably the best person to explain how those particles and waves have been developing in music. But what the review says, that it's a mere four notes on the lower tone bars generating rolling waves of sound, and their constant recombination creates an illusion of harmonic development where little has actually changed. But it's against that. Tiny particles flicker from the upper register until the polarity inverts and the two forces exchange roles completely, coexisting finally in a state of mutual ambivalence. So it's actually a deceptively simple mechanism between two marimbas, but it yields something unexpectedly rich musically.
Yes, I love that approach. I love the way you put it earlier, giving readers a shorthand. And I feel like some anthropologists have tried to do it with photography, like, you know, just giving a picture, or like maybe exploring other media like film, really trying to give your readers like a feel for what's going on without it, like explaining it with the word, which is very linear. But with other media, you can kind of immerse somebody.
I liked to think to myself about the 3D type of project. So you could communicate by text, you could communicate by image, and you could communicate by sound. And all those three dimensions are captured in the book in order to reach out to the complexity that I wanted to convey to the reader.
Methodologically, I think, is a fabulous solution. You already mentioned before that, you know, you see a lot of problems with analysis of Russia that focuses on Moscow, right? Is Moscow centric? And in your book, in this book and other books, you try to, you know, look at the regions, to look at like Russia beyond the MCAD. Could you tell us a bit more about the relationship as you see it between Moscow and the regions?
I should say we have two people from Siberia here.
But to ask where in Siberia you were from, because as soon as I heard Siberia, I was like, okay, I gotta know.
From Novosibirsk Academy town. And I must say my background, which is fully acknowledged in the book, is very much the Novosibirsk School of Sociology, which was Zaslavskaya, Rivkina, Hahulin, a lot of people who worked on rural areas in Altai and Novosibirsk Oblast. And I did a lot of field work when I was a student by collecting data, mainly quantitative data. And I worked very closely with mathematical methods of the analysis. And that kind of modeling, and we already then, that was in the 80s, had computers and perfocards, and we did first analysis with SPSS, or what was recreated by our own programmers as SPSS tools for data analysis. And that really has been a great school in terms of positivism and the way in which the knowledge is created, policy recommendations are made, and all that. So when I changed and I went to study in Cambridge, that really shook my foundations, because it was at the time deeply philosophical, affected by the teachings of Ludwig Wittgenstein and the linguistic turn in philosophy, and also the supervision that I got from Marilyn Strazern and Caroline Humphrey, which a lot of people really still sense in my work, because it is social anthropology. Okay, it's native anthropology, but it's really that kind of bringing people and giving voice to people which are normally unheard or forgotten. And that's why I think my attention to the regions is prominent. However, I'm not a scholar of Russian regions, and I already mentioned Natalia Zubarevich, who created this Four Russias model, which is actually much more complex than it sounds, because it's not that you attribute a region to a particular type of Russia. She shows how four Russias coexist within each region and creates a concoction of types of voting behavior, consumer demand, and patterns of, you know, normative and non-normative behavior. We've got Vladimir Gelman, who actually argued that Russia is not Russia, it's 80 plus regional regimes of power, which are all specific and could not really be seen through the same lens of analysis. And that's where we kind of have to look at the governors and the type of personalized regime, because personalism is a big thing in Russia still. However, in my effort to depersonalize political regimes and take them out of that capture of the personal leadership, I would say that, yes, personalities are very important. However, the Sistema paradox, as I see it, is that every leader in Russia is actually a broker of Sistema, but also its hostage. So you do have a lot of pressures which are levied upon people in power. And very often we tend to think about elites as having agency, but that's exactly the point that I very much wanted to test in my work and just really question as to how much power you have if you step out of line. And in my view, it's not a lot.
In terms of, because we often think, we were told and we read that there is a power vertical, right? That leads from the center out, radiates out. Now, I get the sense of like regional actors are constrained within the system they work. They have some kind of autonomy because of distance, things like this. But what about the center? Because the power vertical idea is that power flows down, right? And results flow up. But is the center also constrained by similar constraints that you find in the regions? How do they relate to one another?
The Sistema is a complex conception, which I define as a multi-vector model of collective action outcome, which is probably too complicated, you know, and it's an academic discourse. But basically, it's the pressure that everyone feels. It's maybe the best explained by reference to Wittgenstein's idea of knowing how to continue the sequence. For example, if I tell you 2, 4, 6, 8, you would be able to continue without understanding the formula. So that's how social norms operate. You are capable of fitting in and continuing with a behavior which is socially acceptable, or testing the borderlines of the acceptability without working out as to what, how, and why. I try to see how the elites operate, for example, and how informal power could be used for informal governance, and how inner circles of leadership operates and what drives them to be what they are, and how they could almost always play double game by being part of Sistema, but at the same time breaking its rules and their own norms in order to stay afloat. And that's what we see quite a lot in the 2022 period, that there is a lot of change in behavior of the elites. And needless to say, there will be many more once Putin is no longer in charge of it.
So does the Putin figure, the central, the patrimonial figure, is the power to determine, to a certain extent, the parameters of acceptable behavior? Because what I've seen, like Putin, one of his mains of governance, in my view, and I'm not, this isn't my own, I've taken it from others, that, like, take corruption. Corruption is both a carrot and a stick. So a carrot, in sense, it keeps elite consolidation, but if an elite goes outside the boundaries of acceptable theft, Putin will smack them down. And the range of acceptable corruption broadens and closes depending on the patrimonial ability to manage the margins, if that makes sense.
It does make perfect sense. The pattern has nothing to do with Putin. The pattern is, Russia's officials are not punished for being corrupt. They are punished for taking more beyond the rank, as it were. So if you want to be corrupt, you have to be it in a systemic way. I've got somewhere in one of the books, I think it was How Russia Really Works, the code of a bribe taker, or the code of kickbacks. If you want to get kickbacks, you have to consult everyone above you. You have to negotiate which percentage is lifted above, as it were. And you have to always reward those who are under you. So that's your idea of the center, right? So what you do, you have that kind of informal financial flows which back up the top and feed the bottom. So if you are a good systema person, what you do, you actually play by the rules in a transparent way, but in the way which is consensual. And that kind of consensus, it doesn't operate at the bottom of the hierarchy. You know, you could be pretty meritocratic when you're young and just being recruited and promoted on the basis of your skills and capabilities. You know, the kind of systema considerations of whether you are the right person to benefit in a big way emerges much higher up at the hierarchy. And that's what my respondents report, that you have institutions work really well and effectively at the level of recruitment at the bottom, a mid-level. The higher you go up, the more that carrot and stick works. Because if you look at the corruption mechanisms, they are not just profiting. What they also do, they ensure that you are the right person for Sistema. You actually submit your economic independence to the collective. To give you a parallel with compromat, for example, and compromising materials or any kind of initiation rites that you find in boarding schools, in totalitarian institutions, in such as mafia organizations, youth gangs, anything, you have to submit a piece of compromat on yourself to be trusted. What it means, you could think Agatha Christie, right? A ritual murder where everyone has to stab in a circle so that no one is guilty. That's another pattern, collective responsibility or collective irresponsibility, as the case could be. So all those patterns of informality, they're really essential to the operating the regime in Russia, which actually has nothing to do with Putin, but historically, they develop in this way. So my vision for the future of Russia beyond Putin is that leadership looks at those patterns and try to work out long-term solutions for those. Because that's the only thing that could create a tectonic change in Russia's development.
I actually love it because there are so many people who are deeply pessimistic. And I mean, you've written 4 books and you've studied Russia for so many years. And it's absolutely wonderful that you still have a glimpse of hope. Speaking of the 4 books, right? You wrote 4 books and 3 of them looked at informality and the Russian system. Could you tell us where does this one fit in your longer intellectual trajectory?
Well, I'm a believer in slow cooking. So my formula for this very short book is 3 + 3 = 1, which is to say I worked on Russia from the informal point of view and the role of informal networks at the everyday level in the first book, business and political networks in the second book, and the top Kremlin-based networks for informal governance in the third book. And then I estranged myself from Russia completely. I effectively left the field in 2013 and started the Global Informality Project because, first of all, I wanted to check the universality of Russia. Second of all, I wanted to see what's happening elsewhere and to compare notes, as it were. And I also wanted to understand informal practices as a phenomenon, not just informality in Russia. With those 3 volumes of the encyclopedia, it allowed me to look at Russia in a different way, sort of in a context-sensitive, comparative way. And that has been quite interesting and different. Hence, it allowed me to do the short book, because once you see the pattern, you could almost capture it in one picture or in one soundtrack. As we've discovered, Benjamin was telling his audience at my recent book launch that he actually first thought that the book was about Russia. But once he started working on music, he discovered that actually patterns are universal. Music is probably the best means to communicate that.
Yeah.
So that's why 3 + 3 = 1.
Yeah. And finally, you know, we started with this line of yours that the West is obsessed with Putin, but is not interested in Russia. For us, say in the United States, why should we care about Russia beyond Putin? Because for us, it's like, well, what is the threat? This is our main kind of concern. What would you say to somebody, let's say a layperson or even a student who might be interested in Russia? What should they care about and why?
Well, first of all, I would say one shouldn't care about Russia. That's what I would say. I mean, hugely inflated approach. Maybe because we cannot face China, Russia is the best proxy. Maybe. But if one does care about Russia, it's better to get it right. Especially, there has been quite a lot of discussion about Russia being a convenient enemy, in the sense that it's not really big. Its population and the corresponding market is small. There are issues within Russia that would ever keep it. I think Rusana said it in the beginning, right? So Russia is always catches up. And there are certain fundamental patterns which actually make sure this is the case. And it's not just Soviet inherited infrastructure, which was not market oriented. There are massive factors which I explain associated with the climate and geography and all the usual suspects which were part of the is Russia normal country or is Russia an abnormal country type of debate.
Right.
But I think maybe people are fascinated by Russia because it's actually complex and it's multi-layered. And I particularly see a lot of interest from those people who have been. Every time I have a US student who come to London to do a postgraduate degree or a PhD, they want to understand how it really works. And that's why they end up with attention to things which are fundamentally elusive, which are hidden practices, which are open secrets, and which are unwritten rules. And that's the know-hows, the savoir-faire, that's non-dit, that's the elephant in the room. And that's what my project, I hope, helps people to get.
That was Alena Ledeneva. Alena Ledeneva is professor of politics and society at the University College London and a founder of the Global Informality Project. She is the author of the trilogy, Russia's Economy of Favors, How Russia Really Works, and Can Russia Modernize? Her new book is The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns, published by UCL Press.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This episode was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. And we are the Eurasian Knot, which is sponsored by the Center for Russia and East European and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And listeners just like yourselves, help us out by spreading the word with the podcast. Turn people onto it. And drop us a line. We have a couple of people who've written us. We should probably highlight some of those things. We got a good thing about Kurt Vonnegut, actually.
Oh, yeah.
That we'll share next time. Yeah. And of course, you know, become a patron. This is a nonprofit endeavor, and we can always use your support. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll be right back. Thank you.